Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. 75 years ago this month, two of the most prominent figures in the nation, William Jennings Bryan and Clarence Darrow, squared off in a Dayton, Tennessee courtroom in an epic battle over the question of whether the teaching of evolution should be banned from the public schools. The trial continues to be a precedent for the legal and political battles that continue to be fought over the same issue. In a moment, we'll revisit the Scopes Monkey trial, but before we do that, let's look at an important event that occurred this week in history. In 1881, Billy the Kid, one of the history's best-known outlaws, was captured and killed by Sheriff Pat Garrett, a one-time Kid loyalist. Born to parents of Irish descent in New York City, William Bonney did not stand out in his early years as an individual destined for trouble. But in 1877, after confronting and killing a bully who had long tormented him, the Kid embarked on a career that claimed the lives of 21 men. In New Mexico's Lincoln County War of 1878, Bonney aligned himself with the Tunstall McSween faction in a merchant war against the Murphy-Dolan entrenched business monopoly throughout the region. Known as the Regulators, Kidd and five other hired guns, including Pat Garrett, engaged in a short-lived career of intimidating, threatening, and even murdering any person who stood in their way. In 1881, Garrett, who had left the Kidd's gang to settle south of the border, was lured by a more than generous offer by law officials to capture Bonney. Garrett was deputized and in April of that year tracked Bonney down. Bonney received a death sentence, but he escaped, and 3 months later was gunned down by Garrett at Fort Sumner, New Mexico. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, after 18 months of investigations and dead ends, a U.S. Justice Department inquiry into the alleged conspiracy surrounding Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination has come up empty. James Earl Ray, who confessed to murdering the civil rights leader in 1969, later recanted and insisted that he was framed by a mysterious figure named Raoul. However, the government maintains, after a year and a half of investigating, that Ray, who died in 1998 while serving out his sentence, was indeed the lone culprit that shocked the nation in 1968. According to officials, Raoul was merely Ray's creation. Many Britons are up in arms over what they claim to be the latest Hollywood misrepresentation of the World War II era. At the center of this latest controversy is the action thriller U-571, a film which depicts the Allied sabotage and sinking of a German sub in 1941. The problem that many Britons have with this recreation is that an Allied submarine crew that included mostly English sailors is depicted as being largely made up of American seamen. Critics contend that for the sake of historical accuracy and in observance of the many British soldiers who made up this particular crew, Hollywood should have attempted to assemble a more representative cast. In spite of these sharp criticisms, which have included critical remarks from Prime Minister Tony Blair, Hollywood executives maintained that the movie was not intended to be historically accurate in the first place. You're listening to Talking History. The Scopes trial, popularly known as the Monkey Trial, and whose 75th anniversary we celebrate this year, was a watershed in our national discussion of science and religion. Our guest today, Edward Larson, argues that in addition to symbolizing the clash between evolutionists and creationists, the trial helped shape the development of both popular religion and constitutional law in the United States. Larson is a professor of history and law at the University of Georgia, and he's the author of Summer for the Gods, The Scopes Trial, and America's Continuing Debate Over Science and Religion. Welcome, Professor Larson.
Thank you.
So why is the Scopes trial considered a watershed case?
It's a watershed case in a variety of different ways. Of course, it was there during the sensation-loving 20s when anything was a phenomenon, and it was a phenomenon even in that decade. Capturing the nation's attention and focusing it really for the first time in a focused way on the issue of religion and politics. And that, of course, has been with us ever since. But that, probably more than anything, both in the way it played out in popular religion and the way it played out in science and in the way it played out in law, sort of raising the issue of anti-clericalism and of the impact of popular religion on law and government on education.
Did it set any precedents, or was it just a one-time deal?
Well, it didn't set any technical legal precedents, but it did ultimately set a tone. It raised, again, for the first time, issues of public concern. If you think back, or neither of us can actually think back to before the Scopes trial, but if you look back as a historian, before that time there was quite a bit of mixing of government and religion. Now, of course, there still is, but there was almost an establishment of sort of a watered down, generalized Protestantism in America. In American life, in not only in education, but in everything running through America. And that had been true ever, probably since the Second Great Awakening. And it raised concerns about that, and it marked the time to moving secularization. Now, that's a funny thing to call a precedent for a trial, because it's not a technical legal precedent in the sense that other courts followed it directly as in the outcome of the case. But rather, they followed in the sense that created a tone that thereafter courts became much more sensitive to those issues.
Well, let me draw you in a little bit closer then. Give me the setting, if you will, for the trial itself.
The setting was a small town in Tennessee, Dayton, Tennessee. The state of Tennessee had recently passed a law making it a misdemeanor, $100 fine, for a But the important thing was making it illegal to teach the Darwinian theory of human evolution. And that set the stage for the test case, because in response to that law, the American Civil Liberties Union issued an invitation that it would defend any school teacher willing to challenge that law in court. Well, they did even better than that. They got a town to challenge it, a town in East Tennessee, which was sort of, if one knows Tennessee, East Tennessee is always alienated from the rest of the state. That's Republican East Tennessee. It had never backed William Jennings Bryan for president. He was an advocate of the law, nor the governor, Austin P., the Democrats that dominated Tennessee legislature that had passed the law. So it was an area that was free to sort of challenge the law, and so really the whole town conspired to bring a test case. Scopes was never threatened with jail. He was never threatened to lose his job. He was well liked in town, and he was the volunteer, the guinea pig, to test this, which even at the time seemed to be a rather bizarre law.
Okay. Now, you mentioned Scopes. His name's on the case, but really he's not the major player here. You've got Darryl and Brian. Can you tell us a little bit about them?
Yes, that's correct. Scopes was sort of a John Scopes was sort of a he was just a volunteer. He wasn't at the heart of the matter at all. What the case was brought by the ACLU, and I would call them a major player as an institution. But what really and the trial would have been national headlines even before William Jennings Bryan and Clarence Darrow became involved. But then it became the front page story, really the only story in America for a month, because once this sort of test case came on the score, and it would just be another regular ACLU test case we have, you know, a couple every year, they do get attention. They are important. But then William Jennings Bryan volunteered to help defend a law, that is, be a volunteer prosecutor for the case. At the time, William Jennings Bryan was one of the most famous speakers in America. He had been Secretary of State. He had been nominated by the Democratic Party for president 3 times. In addition to being politically a progressive and a populist to an extent, and certainly a spokesman for the liberal side in politics, he also was a devoutly religious man, sort of like a Jimmy Carter. And he believed in this law, had been involved in helping to get it passed or promoting it in other places. And when he heard about this test case, he was suspicious. as were any supporters of the law, because it looked like a setup job arranged by the ACLU with a compliant town, a town that also was against the law. And so just to make sure, to keep him honest, as it were, to keep the prosecution honest, he volunteered to go. Well, there you had one celebrity. And remember, this was a decade that loved celebrities. If there was any decade that loved celebrities more than the 1990s, it was the 1920s. And here was a celebrity. Then when Brian got in, Clarence Darrow, the famous defense lawyer, famous because of his abilities as a defense lawyer, but also because of his showmanship, and on top of that, the nation's leading village skeptic on a national scale, I think one of his biographers once described. He sort of had a place that a Carl Sagan might have had in the 1990s, or a Richard Dawkins today, in that he was always challenging religion, religious beliefs, as with Dennett, on very sincere grounds. And so to counter Brian, and because they all loved the limelight, Darrow jumped in too and volunteered, the only time in his entire life that he ever volunteered free legal aid. And this was at a time when he was making $250,000 a case. He volunteered his services for the defense. And so suddenly the media had not only a trial between science and religion, which they were already billing it, not only a trial between individual freedom of academic freedom and freedom of speech versus the power of majority rule, both of which were great selling lines. But now they had two of the most famous people in America, two true celebrities, Brian and Darrow, duking it out over this idea. And as a historian of ideas, I find it just delightful that here the trial of the century and all the other contenders for trial of the century are gruesome murder trials involving vilified defendants. Here you had what ended up being the trial of the century fought over an idea. And as a historian of ideas, I find that just delightful.
Sure, right. Well, we don't have time to talk about the trial in its entirety, but if you had to pick sort of a high point or a turning point in the trial, what would it be?
Well, it's tough to say there was a turning point at the time. Certainly the turning point and the impact of the trial was its later press. In the 30s and 40s, the way the myth, the legend, changed the actual event. At the time, it was viewed pretty much as a draw. We had two able speakers who both made their case and ended up encouraging their own followers and creating an issue that has stayed with us for 75 years. And so both sides succeeded in their end. But certainly the most dramatic moment of the trial came right at the end. After it was all over, after it was thought it was all over, but the closing arguments, Darrow pulled his surprise punch of asking Brian on the stand as an expert witness on the Bible, and Brian vainly agreeing to do so. And there you had these two aging celebrities, not only on either side, as they had been all trial, advocating their point, but actually face-to-face, debating each other in sort of a odd sort of debate where Darrow, one of the great legal interrogators of all time, had the privilege of being able to cross-examine as a hostile witness and therefore use leading questions William Jennings Bryan, and it was the stuff that legends are made of, and it ended up being one of the great American legends.
Wouldn't you have loved to have been there for that? What you called it a draw, but what really was the decision in the case?
Well, technically the decision was, the initial decision was that Darrow had, that Scopes had broken the law, that he had taught evolution. Actually, he never did, but that's beside the point. It was stipulated that he did. And so he was convicted with a $100 fine, which Brian offered to pay. I mean, that wasn't in dispute. Darrow at the end, once the judge said he would not overturn the statute on constitutional grounds, Clarence Darrow actually asked for a conviction because what he wanted to do was to overturn the law as unconstitutional, and so he didn't go for jury nullification or go to get an acquittal. He wanted a conviction, so in that sense, they got the result they want. Both sides got the result they wanted. Then it went up on appeal, and on appeal, the Tennessee Supreme Court, in an obvious subterfuge to defuse the issue, which they found embarrassing, they overturned the conviction, but by a 4-3 vote, they upheld the statute as constitutional, but proceeded to direct in the decision direct that not only that Scopes be not reindicted after being overturned on a technicality, but that the prosecutors of the state, and I'm quoting, to save the peace and dignity of the state, of the state of Tennessee, to never bring another indictment under this statute. So it was technically upheld, but the court ruled that there would be no more indictments ever brought, and there never were. That was it. The letter the law became simply a symbolic act that was after that.
I recall, though, didn't the law stay on the books for a while later?
Yes, it stayed on the books for 30 years and was finally repealed in the 1960s, but only shortly thereafter Tennessee then adopted a new statute, mandating equal time or balanced treatment in their textbooks for creation science balanced against evolution science. So what it in a typically American act, in the 20s it seems fair to abolish evolution, that is, ban the teaching of evolution. Creationism could never be taught back then. So the idea, Brian's idea was you can't teach creationism, so because that would violate church and state, therefore you also don't teach evolution. You have neutrality through silence. Well, that by the 60s, what seems fairer, and today, if you look at public opinion polls, is, you know, in pluralistic America, let both ideas in. So they repealed the statute, but they turned around and then passed a statute saying that we'll have both. Now, that was thrown out by the courts as unconstitutional, but that's what they tried to do.
You say the mood today is to let sort of both ideas in, and I'm thinking of what happened in Kansas recently. Is there a connection there?
Yeah, and Kansas would be, you make me squirm with that, because Kansas, of course, is an example to the opposite. I'm coming, though, from public opinion polls, that the public opinion polls, it doesn't matter who takes them, tend to show teach all these ideas, let all these different ideas in. Kansas did not do that, of course. Kansas removed evolution from its guidelines, and I think that's probably the Achilles heel of that. I'm talking not now as a lawyer, but as a follower of politics, that's probably the political Achilles heel of that decision, and my guess is that Kansas and historians should never make predictions, and here I've gotten myself out on the gangplank and about ready to fall into the water, but my prediction is that this school board will not be reelected this year in Kansas, or at least enough of them will lose so that restriction will be voluntarily pulled down next year.
Well, we may have to call you back on that.
I know this is talking history. You'll have to talking future events.
Right, exactly. Well, let me ask you then one last question. Most of our listeners, if they know anything about the Scopes trials, are probably going to know it through the film Inherit the Wind. Your commentary, was the film, it certainly was a blockbuster and a great success. Was it fair to the trial?
It's a great film. It's a good play. It's a very good play. It's not about the Scopes trial, though, and Lawrence and Lee, Bob Lee and Jerome Lawrence would be the first to say that. They were the first to say it. They said it in the playbill when it originally came out on Broadway. It's really a play about McCarthyism. They were trying to attack the blacklisting of writers and authors in the whole McCarthy era, and it was during the 50s. And they did the same thing that Arthur Miller did with The Crucible, and then project it back onto a past historical event. When they did the play, fundamentalism was almost invisible in America, and they were just straw men to stand in for McCarthyism. And so the play, I think, is a wonder, as a historian, I think it's a wonderful play to tell us about the 50s. It's not a very good play to tell us about the 20s. They change characters. They change the issue. The issue, it's a different story. So it's a great play, and certainly the movie, Spencer Tracy is absolutely wonderful in the movie. So I recommend it to people, but not as history.
Right. Understand. Okay. Well, we'll leave it at that. And thank you for being with us. It was a good conversation.
Thank you very much.
I hope to talk to you again soon. You've been listening to Edward Larson, author of Summer for the Gods, The Scopes Trial and America's Continuing Debate Over Science and Religion. And you are listening to Talking History. Thank you.
as alluded to in our talk with Edward Larson, the issues that provoked the Scopes Muckey trial 75 years ago continue to challenge us today. That's the subject of our op-ed of the week, The Debate That Won't Die, by Neil Jumonville. Jumonville is William Warren Rogers Professor of History at Florida State University.
For a half a century after the end of the Scopes trial in Dayton, Tennessee in 1925, historians thought that the struggle against teaching evolution, led by Christian fundamentalists, was dead. It's not. As a rule, historians who wrote of the Muckey trial ended their accounts with the creationists defeated and the debate buried. But in retrospect, it appears that the populist resentment against evolution never ended. Instead, for decades, it remained seething beneath the surface of our political culture unnoticed. One remembers that John Dewey, a prominent voice of the 1920s, warned that problems are often not solved. They merely give way to others. The return of the problem today has been accompanied by its earlier logic. There's a striking similarity between the reasoning used in the current debate over the teaching of creationism and the debate 75 years ago in Tennessee. In both cases, creationist forces have asked that we solve the problem by using popular sovereignty, letting the great mass of people, acting in a decentralized fashion, decide for themselves the truth they will teach their children. As William Jennings Bryan, the most recognized of the creationist leaders, announced in 1923, "Teachers in the public schools must teach what the taxpayers desire taught. The hand that writes the paycheck rules the school." Similarly, last year, the Kansas Board of Education instructed each of the state's 304 districts to decide for itself what proportion of creationism and evolution it will teach. In the United States, we have a long tradition of debate about the virtues and drawbacks of popular sovereignty, and sometimes we have not allowed the majority to choose. Consider, for example, the Lincoln-Douglas debates over slavery. It was Stephen Douglas and the slave interests, after all, who encouraged popular sovereignty as a way to decide whether there should be slavery in the Western territories. It was Lincoln who opposed popular sovereignty and maintained that there are public actions that a simple show of hands can't justify. And anyway, the virtue of popular sovereignty aside, it's not clear whether a show of hands can adjudicate science. While they are voting on evolution, should we encourage localities to vote on how electricity works or how planes are suspended in air? In the face of current genetic discoveries, today's Christian populace will have a much harder time refuting science and evolution than they did in Tennessee in 1925. And because of that, they will have a much harder task making their case for popular sovereignty.
You have been listening to Neil Jumonville, William Warren Rogers Professor of History at Florida State University. Professor Jumonville's op-ed comes to us courtesy of the History News Service. This is Talking History. For our recommended historic site of the week, we have selected an electronic means by which you can view one of the world's largest, grandest, and most historic art collections. Here to tell you more about the electronic site is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
The State Hermitage Museum in St. Petersburg, Russia, and IBM have launched a website that will eventually display all 3 million of the institution's pieces. The site, hermitagemuseum.org, features a searchable digital library database of almost 3,000 high-resolution images from 12 different categories, ranging from arms and armor to paintings, prints, and drawings. Visitors to the site can look for a piece not only by its name, but by its shape and color as well. Visitors can also take virtual tours of the museum's ornate rooms and halls. A visit to the Hermitage Museum website is a wonderful alternative if you can't make it in person to the museum in Russia.
Thank you, Cindy. And if you visit the Hermitage website and want the opportunity to see some of the treasures of Imperial Russia in a spot closer than St. Petersburg, you might take advantage of this week's recommended coming attraction, Unseen Treasures, Imperial Russia and the New World. An exhibit that includes some 350 rare Russian art objects has opened at the Missouri History Museum in St. Louis. The exhibit celebrates the 200th anniversary of the Russian-American Corporation, which managed most of what is now Alaska until 1867. On a walk through the exhibit, visitors encounter Catherine the Great and her ornate coronation sleigh, a painting of the wealthy wife of a Siberian merchant, the brass wedding crowns held over the heads of brides and grooms to symbolize their new positions as kings and queens of their new homes, and the deerskin fur vestments of a Russian priest. Also on display are numerous historical documents and letters illustrating the close ties between Russia and the United States during the 1800s. About 70% of the items in the exhibit, by the way, have never been on display, even in Russia. For more information on the exhibit Unseen Treasures, which runs through August 20th, contact the Missouri History Museum in St. Louis. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you will join us next week when we will be talking to Thomas Keneally about his best-selling book, The Great Shame and the Triumph of the Irish in the English-speaking World. Until then, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. From the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, this is Brian LeBeau.
Here we come, walk down the street, get funny as well, everyone we meet. Hey, we're the monkeys, people say we're monkeying around, we're too busy singing to put anybody down. We do whatever we want to, do what we like to do, we don't have time to get restless. There's always something new. Hey, we're the monkeys. The people say we're monkey around. We're too busy singing to put anybody down. We're just trying to be friendly. Come and watch, sing and play. We're the young generation. We've got something to say.
Oh.
Anytime or anywhere, just look over your shoulder, cause you'll be standing there.
Hey, hey, we're the monkeys, and people say we monkey around, but we're too busy singing, but anybody down.
Thank you.